Good evening, everyone. Across Asia and Europe, the funds to tackle climate change already exist, but much of this capital remains idle. The challenge is not scarcity, but how to activate these resources so they flow to green projects that protect and sustain the planet. In this episode of AIB Podcast, we will explore how governments, investors, and communities are rethinking finance for the green transition. I'm Han, your moderator for today's panel discussion. And joining me are our esteemed experts. First, we have Professor Johan Sulaiman, Director of Sustainable and Green Finance Institute, SGFIN, and Professor of Finance at NUS Business School at the National University of Singapore. We also have Dr. Vincent Lim, Chief Financial Officer at ASTAR, an R&D agency governed by Singapore's Ministry of Trade and Industry. Last but not least, we have Eloise O'Carroll from the European Commission. She's the Programme Manager in charge of Forestry, Natural Resources and Energy at the EU Delegation to Indonesia. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. Let's start with the first question, maybe. Okay, so this is for everyone. What does green finance mean to you, and how does it differ from traditional finance?
I'll take it first. So thanks for having me. So green finance is, to some extent, in a lot of ways, very similar to conventional finance. It is about allocation of resources. When I think about green finance, I see it as a powerful tool to align economic progress with environmental and social responsibility. Right? It's about allocating and channeling resources into projects, initiatives that can help to protect our planet and our society. So we can think about things like renewable energy, sustainable agriculture, even climate resilient infrastructure as part of this equation. So therefore, this green finance is just a shift in perspective to some extent, right? We typically are allocating resources in finance to projects that are the most profitable. Now we are trying to allocate resources to projects that will sustain us the longest in this planet. Profitability and sustainability, they don't have to be at odds. I think they can work hand in hand. And I think green finance recognizes this potential of having the synergy between profitability and sustainability so that finance can be a tool, an equipment, a facility for economic growth, right? And also for environmental and social well-being.
I'd be happy to chime in here, but I think the introductory definition was really, really valuable. Maybe just to add one nuance is that maybe it's important for us to look at green finance with respect to our climate commitment. So for me, I work for the EU. So with the EU, we have a commitment with our 27 member states to reach climate neutrality in 2050, and that's in law. And on that journey, we obviously need to finance things that have an environmental and social impact that is green. But on our transition to net zero, there's also what we call transition finance, and that's for financing economic activities that today might not be fully green, but that are, you know, in the process of becoming green, to add some differentiation in terms of financing that we see. And so it's really important to bear this in mind, that there's also some nuances in the types of activities that we finance, but all are really crucial to meet our net zero targets.
So I basically agree with the fellow panelists, but I want to add one additional item. Green finance, in my personal opinion, has been around for a very long period of time. But in the recent age or recent few years, 1 or 2 years, I think the clarity has not been there. There are a lot of people who talk about green finance, and then it is basically just a bond that is linking with some ESG. That basically some money, but capital is idle if we don't have clarity. And what kind of clarity are we looking at? I think if we talk a little bit deeper, it could be 14064, the ability to calculate to the, for example, the emission. When people talk about net zero, it could be carbon neutrality, 14068, for example. It could be the ability to use ISSB S2 and calculate the specific number. So I think green finance need to have a little bit of additional clarity, and it's no longer the same as what we have for the past, like maybe 20 years, 30 years ago. But in the current age, it should be slightly more pragmatic and slightly more clear.
So there is a lot of chatter that despite all the commitments that have been made to green finance, very little of it has actually been disbursed. From your experience in your line of work, is that true? And if so, why? So Johan, let's start with you and maybe Vincent.
Okay, so I think I would echo what Vincent is saying, which is that I think the capital is quite inactive right now. It's not scarce. I think we have capital. The issue is the lack of understanding about what can generate the most impact. So I think this goes back to Eloy's point earlier about sustainable and social and environmental impact, and capital is looking for actual impact, right? Because otherwise, the investors will struggle basically to find clear impact, credible impact, clear data. And this goes back to Vincent's earlier point about clarity, right? I think they're looking for clarity so that they understand what is the risk in the projects, what is the opportunity in the project, and therefore we can do our use of financial modeling, right? So we can do valuation, so we understand how to value projects more easily. There are many assets that already exist in the economy that are right now actually are becoming less liquid because our inability to evaluate climate risks, not just transition risk but also physical risks like flood risks. And all these things actually require just better measurement of risk and better measurement of potential opportunities. And once that happens, it'll be much easier for capital to flow into these projects to be deployed into worthy projects that can generate hopefully beneficial impact for the for the sustainability of the planet. One last thing I want to say is that the cost of capital being on the sideline is huge because in the long run, right, if we don't transition as more quickly, then we will need to spend more money on that adaptation.
Okay, Vincent, over to you.
Fully agree with Johan, right? And I think we listen like this. Sometimes people don't get it. Don't get what Johan mentioned. It's so true. But I just want to share, right? Not so long ago, I was in COP28 and it was in Dubai, and I delivered a speech in Dubai during the Green Zone, and I said carbon credit could be the next financial instrument to save many things, among them our carbon emission. And there were people come up and say, "Oh, Vincent, you are, allowing people to use money to avoid their responsibility." But you remember I was speaking in Dubai, and Dubai, Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, all these very nice places, they are basically oil producing organization and country, right? So the ability for us to so I told them the ability for us to criticize people who are focusing on green finance or carbon credit or carbon related financial instruments is very low if you are doing absolutely nothing. The ability to actually know what is the real amount that the capital is contributing is very crucial. Today, if I say $1, how many carbon are you reducing? That is a bit low, right? So that is a bit unclear. So basically, this is the view, pretty strong one, that we need to have stronger clarity to enable capital. Otherwise, the green financing is, a bit slower recently.
I think in forestry, one of the key developments in the recent decades, but increasingly so in the past couple of years, is the use of Earth observation, so satellite monitoring to monitor forestry using satellites from space. So at the EU, we have the Copernicus program, which is our flagship space program. And there's a number of Sentinel satellites that go around the world, so paid for and managed by the European Space Agency to assess many things, including forestry or vegetation, so forest cover, but also things like water, oceans, coastal, to really assess what's going on and to see the impact of human life basically on the planet.
But I want to go back to our previous question, which is about unlocking capital. So we've learned that, okay, there's lots of technology that's being deployed now for monitoring deforestation or forest growth, correct? But is all that technology, is that inspiring confidence among investors, and is that unlocking capital for you?
Indeed, it is. It is inspiring confidence, and it can unlock capital if the tools are there. So one way in which we, the EU, support unlocking this private capital in this case is through the European Fund for Sustainable Development Plus, EFSD Plus, which is the financial arm of the Global Gateway, which is our strategy to boost climate smart investments around the world in a way that's environmentally and socially mindful. So looking at infrastructure, but also governance, education, and so on. Through this instrument, we provide guarantees as well as grants and concessional loans. And through the guarantees here, we can guarantee private sector lenders. So for example, think of Dutch Development Bank FMO, to invest in carbon sinks in key countries. Indonesia could be a potential candidate, but many countries in the region are eligible for our guarantee cover to enable them to invest more and to share the risk with us. And this is something that's really great and that's starting to work around the world. And this is a model that we are really looking to replicate in key markets for nature-based solutions, as one example.
Okay, we've just heard a mixed bag of lots of wonderful new climate innovation technologies that you just mentioned. But I want to come back to the expert that we have here on the panel, which is Vincent. So, next question is for you. In your opinion, what is the latest in climate technology innovation, and which ones, in your opinion, are the best bets for green financing?
This is an exciting time. So just now we just heard about the carbon capture and utilization and storage. But in carbon captures and store is so simple, right? We think about, oh, pumping the carbon into the ground. You need pressure and temperature, and therefore it's about 800 meter deep, usually 1 to 3 kilometer, usually, but minimum 800 meter. In Singapore, I don't know if there's any place that we can do that. So utilization of carbon after carbon sequestration is, I think, the next potential way where we can look at a real innovation. So you can utilize by, let's say, methane pyrolysis, or you can use that through simple things like maybe take A-STAR, for example. So A-STAR, we have about 7 programs, but one of them is the ability to go to rubbish. So we have a Semakau Island, for example. Take rubbish, grind it, add carbon into it, and make it into sand. So once it's crystallized into sand, we can use it for construction, and we can use it into bricks. We can use it for many, many other things. The ability to sell this brick doesn't make a lot of sense because I can create bricks in a simpler way and cheaper. But the ability to use mandatory carbon credit, for example, will be very, very exciting. The second technology maybe is SAF. SAF stands for Sustainable Aviation Fuel. The most recent newspaper article states very clearly the ministry's intention to ensure that every single flight from Singapore is through sustainable aviation fuel. So, ladies and gentlemen, what is SAF? Where do we get? Today, not many people know what we don't really have. So the largest test rig in the world last year was from A-STAR, and we have it in Jurong Island. We have been testing the ability for us to generate SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. And today, the quantity is not a lot. So, ladies and gentlemen, think a little bit. If the whole Singapore flight will have to be on SAF, and today our supply is so low, wow. I'm just predicting the future, but wow, the potential is so big. And how many people are investing with us? Not many, man. Today we have IHI, Japanese company. Singapore, oh, some startup, small ones. So the ability for us to recognize the potential and actually do it, there's so much, but how many people actually do it? I didn't see a lot. So the third is, for example, hydrogen. And hydrogen is so easy, right? Oh, just use hydrogen. It's not like that, right? It's the ability to carry hydrogen. So to carry hydrogen, you need ammonia. And to manage ammonia, it is a totally new technology also. The essence or the summary of what I wanted to say is that the potential for innovation and research is so large. But there are not many people who are looking at this. Most of the people when I talk in university and also conferences is to do something very, very simple, is reduce electricity, reduce water, reduce waste. If it's so simple, I think the ability for us to move green finance forward is clarity, but at the same time, letting our colleagues, potential, advocates to really understand the deep tech and the power of innovation.
Okay, this one is for Johan, actually. I think you got something to say. So we've heard about Vincent advocating for number one, CCU, carbon capture and utilization. Number two, SAF. Number three, hydrogen, preferably green hydrogen, yeah? What are your thoughts about the business model and the commercialization about these three innovations that he just talked about?
Look, I think the point that Vincent made earlier, right? If it's a simple project, simple technology, and it's readily profitable, then it would have been done, right? Reducing water, reducing waste, if to the extent that it's economically viable, companies would have done it. Now, what is left are things that are relatively difficult, technologically challenging, potentially unprofitable at the moment. So this technology requires several things. One is de-risking. I think I always talk about de-risking some of the technology. You also can go the other side, which is to increase the potential revenue by generating demand, right? Incentivizing companies by providing stable demand for their technology, the new technology. And finance will only flow to some extent if we either reduce the risk or increase profitability, right? By generating this stable demand. So for all the technology that Vincent is saying, right, the demand now is actually quite limited, right? Because like Vincent said, look, you can find bricks cheaper some other way. You can find jet fuel some easier way, some cheaper way than all these things that are being discussed. I think regulations and some clarity will result in demand for these more sustainable products. And I think scaling is the issue here, right? So when you talk about finance, I think it cannot be in isolation relative to regulations and policies because we need to generate economic demand for these products. But I think the hope to me is like the younger generation is probably more sensitive to this. This is their planet. And to some extent, they're probably more willing to pay for this.
So realistically, though, in our current economic climate, not just in Singapore, but also globally, is it realistic, number one, for regulators to push for off-takers to buy into such premium technologies? Or number two, is it responsible for consumers to expect consumers to pay the premium for such technology?
The answer is yes. These are opportunities, right? Look at the Chinese EV producers. You may think of this as subsidy, but every kind of industrial policy is a subsidy, right? Now you can choose where to subsidize some of these technologies, and why don't we choose these ones, right? Where we can not only generate profits in the future, but also generate a more sustainable planet. I sound like an activist now. I am not an activist. I can assure you, right? I'm very skeptical about a lot of technologies, but and some technology may not deserve this treatment, right? We need to think hard about which technology deserve treatments that, like you said, could be costly right now. But in the long run, I think these technologies, particularly promising ones, not only will generate a more sustainable planet, but also will generate profitability for the company, for the society, for the country.
Okay, so beyond technology, green finance is also about ensuring a just transition. So this question is for Johan. Help us explain what's a just transition and how that is related to transition financing.
So we talk a bit about, profitability and balancing profitability and sustainability. A lot of times we're not balancing profitability with sustainability, right? What we are balancing is sustainability and economic development. So when we talk about just transition, what we are concerned about is that the transition to a more sustainable world may result in less sustainable communities. In the sense that if we make the poorest of the poor pay for our transition, the global transition, then clearly we are not doing right by them. Number one is the understanding that transition is difficult, and the poorest of society will be the will likely to pay the cost if we do it and if we don't do it, right? So we need to balance that as well. If we don't do the transition properly, the poorest will also get hurt. So we do need to think about the fact that the poorest will get hurt the most. The second is the need for governments to intervene in this process, because regulations will need to change in order for this to happen. Policies need to change in order for this to happen. It's not just capital. We need policies, we need regulations. And the last one is, I think we're gonna talk a bit about this, is blended financing will be critical as well, because the fact of the matter is some of these just transition initiatives will lose money in the process. We need governments and donors to be able to step in and say, look, we're gonna de-risk some of these things so that private capital can flow in to support the process.
Okay, so this one is for Eloise. The EU is a global leader for green finance and a pioneer of mechanisms to support this just transition. So tell us a bit more about the EU Green Deal and how it translates this principle into practical support, especially as what Johan mentioned earlier, especially for the communities that depend on fossil-based industries.
Indeed, I think Prof. Johan made some really, really good points there on the economics, the case to really diversify from these fossil or carbon intensive industries, but we must not forget the communities. In the 1990s, in northern France, for example, when there was economic downturn linked to mass coal mine closure that was not necessarily planned, because France then was attracted more by nuclear energy and developed that instead, or coal prices were low. So when there was this downturn that was not planned for in advance, there was a massive loss of jobs and livelihoods, and communities are still facing challenges today in northern France. And really, to add to the economic question is the socioeconomic angle of community mobilization and diversification and long-term planning. And so for this now in the EU, this is something that in the Green Deal, so which is, as mentioned, our flagship policy, a law to be climate neutral by 2050. We have various mechanisms to plan the just transition adequately over time and with consistency at a regional level. And for this, there are many, many funds. One is called the Just Transition Fund. Essentially, it aims to support communities, regions, and local governments and national governments with funding from the EU, but also with funding from the member state itself to transition away from either the fossil fuel or the industry that they were dependent on, and to diversify and to find other means of socioeconomic diversification. And so this Just Transition Fund, it's nearly 20 billion euros in grants and current prices, with additional financing from member states. So one of these flagship projects that was launched or opened rather just a couple of months ago is in Estonia. It's the Neo Materials Rare Earth Magnet Factory. And magnets, we know, are really important for the green transition and for Europe's energy transition, as these magnets are present in wind turbines and electric vehicles. We also work on the just transition abroad with partner countries, and Indonesia is a key partner country. I'm based in Jakarta, and I also work on the Just Energy Transition Partnership, or JETP, with the government of Indonesia and with partners. So there's nine public partners, and then a group of commercial banks who together have pledged around $20 billion in public and in private financing to really accelerate renewables, as well as accelerate the supply chains around renewables, transmission lines, skills, all of this, and moving away from coal in Indonesia. And so for us at the EU, we work in what we call a Team Europe approach. So that means we work really closely with our member states that are present here in Indonesia, but also with their banks, with their development finance institutions. So in particular here, we have the European Investment Bank. We also have the French Development Bank, AFD, and the German, KfW.
So I'm curious about your thoughts on this, Vincent. Just now, Eloise spoke about accelerating renewables in Indonesia, but there's also a lot of anxiety about whether this transition, it could be a transition towards renewables. It could also be transition towards AI or just automation in general. And I guess particularly from the AI point of view, that AI consumes too much energy.
So if we look at the current AI capability, it is being used in many areas that are sustainability related. The ability for some of us to look at data center, and when I say some of us, it is beyond A-Star. It was also with Google and Meta. To use AI in the ability to reduce data centers' electricity usage is very, very crucial. And we are looking at like 50% reduction. 50%. So no AI, yeah, continue spending that kind of electricity. With AI, you have a 50% reduction of electricity. So the more we use, the less carbon we have in the atmosphere. And of course, if you look at just one sectors in silo, then you say, oh, you know, don't use. Then then we miss out in many other things. The government has built the latest data center in Jurong Island. And through hydrogen energy. So we basically term it as sustainable energy, but we are trying hydrogen. And to use hydrogen, I just now mentioned we need ammonia, right? So the ability for the sector to focus on real technology to achieve sustainability is so crucial.
So this has been a really valuable discussion, guys. So we have to wrap it up now. Last and final question with COP30 around the corner. What is your ideal outcome from COP30, and would that outcome be likely? So all views are welcome, whether they are pessimistic or optimistic.
I want to start because I don't want to be the final word on this. I'm quite cautious in terms of what COP30 or any COP can achieve. Our experience, our shared experience so far is that there have always been issues with implementation, right? It's difficult to agree on things, but even after countries agree, the implementation still lacks urgency, still lacks immediacy. So my sense is that going forward, we may see countries moving independently, but I hope that they are still moving towards a shared goal, which is that we need to save the planet at some level, right? This is not going to be efficient because the EU will go in one direction, Asian countries will go in some other direction. There will be duplication of efforts, there will be conflict of efforts. But this may be the only path we have, and the task I think at hand is to be able to try to minimize this duplication, making sure that the efforts are compatible with each other. So we end up, I think we're gonna have more paperwork, more standards, more verification, and hopefully more transparent data as a result. So that's where I think a lot of our research at SGFin is going towards this. We want to make sure that once the data is ready, we have the infrastructure to process the data, right? We are able to value impact more succinctly. We can support blended financing because it's going to be needed anyway, and we can support technology adoption. Like Vincent is saying, there are a lot of technology. How can we facilitate the adoption of the technology? And I think this is what we can do. I mean, we cannot hope for COP30 to make huge progress, but all of us will need to do our share.
So if we look at COP, I always teach my student and the conferences. Some of them are very, very successful. Anyone remember Kyoto Protocol? Kyoto Protocol saved us, saved like the entire humanity. It's a foundation for many, many things.
It's a long time ago,
1997,
Vincent. This is a
Kyoto,
long time ago.
long time ago. So it was very successful. And then we have Paris Agreement, 2015, very, very successful. But somewhere after that, like nothing much. You know, I was a speaker in COP28, right? I went there with full of excitement. I came back just shopping, and then I drank some coffee, nice Turkish coffee. But basically, that's about all. But I think the key is like this. One of the things I hope to achieve is related to just transition, for example. So when I talk about the countries to my students and to my audiences, many people will point out, oh, China is the biggest polluter in the world. And it's true. They are true. But, you know, ladies and gentlemen, so many people just jump in and say, oh, this country are no good. But number one, many of the products that we buy came from there, right? And then they admit we buy. If you want to blame them, don't buy. Number two, per capita, they are actually quite okay now. There are a few countries, they are near to the oil producing area. Per capita, the highest, like by a lot in the world. Number three, you know, when we talk about just transition, right? So some of these developing countries, they have been developing for a very, very long period of time. Some of the developed countries have been developed for the recent like 50 years. So we are kind of like enjoyed for a long period of time. We now come back to them and say, hey, you cannot emit carbon. I'm not that sure whether that's just or whether that's reasonable. So there are many, many reasons. I really hope that we ignore the border of the nations and able to come and sit in and decide just like Kyoto, just like Paris Agreement. So I really hope at COP30 we have a real like agreement, real discussion, real sign something and do something. But it's still a hope. So you ask for hope. Yeah, that's my hope.
Listen, we always have to see things glass half full, otherwise we wouldn't be here. I think we need to recognize, 2025, that's 10 years from the Paris Agreement, which, as was mentioned, is one of these flagship COPs, because basically nearly all countries in the world, I think 195 of them, minus one more recently, and then a couple, really a small handful that didn't sign up, pledged to join the Paris Agreement to maintain global heating to well below pre-industrial levels, so 1.5 degrees, to maintain a livable planet. And since then, with the pledges, so with the nationally determined contributions of the countries, we've managed to move to shift the needle from global heating of predicted 4 degrees by the end of the century to around 2.7 now. So of course it's not enough, and of course we can do more, and of course multilateralism can be reformed so that we can be more effective in our decision making, in our implementation, and in our global alignment. But we must also celebrate what multilateralism has provided for us, also in Kyoto, how we work together to really raise the ambition, to raise the climate ambition for all countries, and to do so in a more just manner. As indeed, many states and many small island developing states, for example, face much starker consequences than us in some other countries, geographically due to their topography, due to the nature of them being small islands. So, as always, we will remain committed in the EU despite others changing their minds, and we stay the course. But of course, we need to act with other countries in the world to really push for more ambition collectively, for more climate ambition.
Okay, so in sum, there's a lot more work to be done at COP30, but let's also not forget that a lot of work has already been done. There has been impact, the needle has shifted, and there is more work to be done. Can we all agree on that?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Okay, so this has been the Green Finance episode of AIB Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for our panelists. Thank you, everyone.